Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by San Francisco State University's graduate business programs offering 5 accredited advanced degrees, the SF State MBA, rigorous, real-world, respected, open house schedule, and more information at mba.sfsu.edu.
Funds for the California Report are provided by Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information available at chevron.com. The California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, it's one of the toughest jobs out there, raising kids.
Dad, could we have a pet?
Now look, guys, we've been over all this before. I have to tell you to wash up for supper. Your mother has to tell you to clean up your room. Now, when you show us that you can take care of yourselves and your room, then we'll talk about a pet.
Parenting today has very little resemblance to the Leave It to Beaver show. It's often a lot more complicated. Single moms, two moms, single dads, working parents.
Rushing in the morning is no fun at all, especially trying to rush kids. It's just, you're guaranteed to have a meltdown, guaranteed to have a disaster, trying to get a four-year-old to hurry up and put on his clothes.
It's all about healthy parenting, a special edition of the California Report. Goes without saying that no two children are exactly alike. Different temperaments and personalities. Even twins have their subtle differences. One thing they all have in common, though, they don't come with user manuals. So parents do the best they can and hope it all works out. The good news, it usually does. But we're devoting our whole show today to healthy parenting, and we begin at the beginning, pregnancy. A national service is using cell phones to help moms-to-be have a successful pregnancy. Kenny Goldberg from KPBS tells us how the Text for Baby program is working in San Diego.
When Janae Watson was about 6 months pregnant, a nurse at the clinic told her about the Text for Baby program. Women who sign up for the free service get 3 health-related text messages per week on their mobile phone. Watson says she's sold on it.
It's really to the point, and then it just tells you what you should ask the doctor so you can get, you know, an actual answer from a doctor and not something on the internet that could be true or not true. You can't just Google everything. You'll get like 10 different answers.
Hey. You saying hi?
Watson's daughter, Lila, was born a month ago. Text for Baby continues to send Watson messages, reminding her about vaccinations and well baby checkups.
I always have my phone with me, and I'm always going through my text messages, so even if like I forget to read it or something, I can go back and it's there, and it's always with me on my phone. Or if I'm at a doctor's appointment and I don't remember what it reminded me for, I can just go back.
When a pregnant woman signs up for the program, she enters her due date. Each text message she receives contains health tips and resources, all timed to coincide with either a particular stage of pregnancy or a particular stage in a baby's first year of life.
So the one that I got this morning says, flu season is here and we're checking in with moms. Are you planning to get a flu shot this season? Reply 1, yes, 2, no, 3, if you've already got it.
So press 1 and see what happens.
Okay.
Barbara Mandel directs the San Diego County Medical Society Foundation.
Okay, so here's the response I got back. Great, the flu shot will help keep you and your baby healthy this season. Would you like to get a reminder to get a flu shot? Reply 1, yes, 2, no.
Mandel's group leads the San Diego County Text for Baby Coalition. It's made up of 40 local nonprofits involved in maternal and child health. To be sure, there's plenty of information on maternal and child health available on the internet. But Mandel says Text for Baby is a different way of getting the message out.
What we've learned is that there are many folks who don't have access to computers or don't use computers often, but have a high use of text messaging.
The target audience is young, low-income expectant mothers. The messages are available in English or Spanish. Text for Baby is a national service. San Diego's free program is one of only a handful that offers local referrals to doctors, clinics, and breastfeeding support. Some 2,400 San Diegans have signed up for it. Mandel says the concept of using text messaging to encourage healthy behavior is becoming more popular.
They've been using it for diabetes and for some cardiac care as well. This is the first time that text messaging is being used for getting messages out to expectant new moms. And we are trying to prove the efficacy of that technique.
San Diego's Text for Baby program is the first to formally evaluate how the service is being used. UC San Diego gynecologist Yvette LaCoursière is one of the evaluators.
So over 60% of women said that the service actually reminded them of an appointment or an immunization that they or their baby needed. 38% of women actually reported that they used a phone number that they received and called a resource that was based on the service.
Dr. LaCoursière says she was initially worried that Text for Baby would prompt too many unnecessary calls to physicians.
What we found, though, is it actually opens a dialogue. 75% of women who use the service said that they've learned a piece of information and that they brought that information to their doctor and started a discussion with them.
LaCoursière says even some of her fellow physicians who've signed up say they've learned something new. The next step is to find out whether women who use Text for Baby have better health outcomes. They hope to have some answers on that front sometime next year. For the California Report, I'm Kenny Goldberg in San Diego.
Of course, it takes more than texting to help some parents succeed. Imagine growing up with a mom or dad who's addicted to drugs or alcohol, then finding yourself following in their footsteps. Reporter Alice Daniel talks with two single parents who are trying to break the cycle of neglect and drug abuse through a parenting program in Fresno.
We'll start with the legs, the feet, the tummy, the chest, the arms, the back, and finally the face.
It's hard not to smile at the infant massage class going on inside the West Care Rehabilitation Center in Fresno. The babies are stretching their little bodies, and some are cooing and laughing.
She's having a lot of fun.
26-year-old Lydia Vigil deftly rocks another mother's baby in her arms while her own baby boy sleeps nearby. This pleasant moment belies a hard truth. She and the other mothers are fighting an internal battle to stay off drugs. When Vigil was pregnant last year, she was addicted to methamphetamine.
It had a really strong hold on me. Like I said, I've been doing it since I was 17. It's my way of numbing out to reality. It keeps me from facing reality. I've had a really difficult life.
She grew up taking care of her 10 younger siblings while her mother abused drugs and alcohol.
I remember my mom overdosing. I remember her laying naked sometimes. I remember having to... not knowing what guy was in the house, you know? I remember stuff like that. I remember trying to keep the house clean and get my brothers and sisters fed and bathing. That's all I remember. I was never really a child. I just don't want my kids to have memories like that.
Vigil got hooked on meth as a teenager. Since then, she's had 4 children. She lost custody of 2 of them, but she is intent on keeping the 2 younger ones, the baby and a 15-month-old daughter. She decided to get clean when she felt her son kick in the womb.
I was really done. I woke up one day and I didn't want to do it anymore.
She's been clean for 8 months and is taking parenting classes here at the Residential Rehab Center. Aside from bonding with her 3-month-old in the massage class, she's learning about child development and positive discipline techniques. She says the program called Smart 2 has given her a lot.
The second chance. My sobriety. I have 8 months clean today. Clarity. Knowing that I'm worthy. You know, that I deserve to be happy. And that I deserve to be a mother to my kids.
Even after Vigil moves out next month, she won't be on her own. She'll have guidance from people like Leticia Azuma, the child development specialist for the program.
We have parents who, once we build that relationship, they want to keep coming back.
Oh, yeah. There he goes.
Neil Dancer is a father who keeps returning to parenting classes. Today, he's down on the floor playing a game with his daughters, 3-year-old Mary Jane and 4-year-old Hannah. Dancer used meth for 9 years. The irony was he thought he was doing a good enough job parenting. His own parents were drug addicts and had abandoned him to his grandparents when he was a little boy. He figured he was doing well enough just keeping his kids with him.
I still had my kids. Like, I thought I was doing a parent better than my dad, better than my mom. But I wasn't. I was just the same exact thing like them.
Then Child Protective Services took his kids away. That's when he decided to quit.
It's really hard. I mean, you just don't. Sometimes people have to lose something really bad to get clean.
He's been clean for a year, and he got his kids back from CPS a month ago. Single parenting is no walk in the park, he says. One reason why he's thankful for the ongoing classes. He's learned patience and control, especially when his daughter Mary Jane gets mad.
Let her throw a little tantrum, give her a moment, and walk away, and then come back to her. You just can't fight a kid when they're throwing a fit.
And for parents in rehab programs like this one, it's a tough fight all the way around. About half the clients manage to keep custody of their children. For the California Report, I'm Alice Daniel in Fresno.
Kids may not come with operating instructions, but they do come with their own traditional colors, pink and blue. Blogger and stay-at-home dad Mike Adamick went shopping and found those gender designations pretty annoying.
I'm standing in the toy section of Target, noting the store has helpfully gender-coded the aisles. Pink for girls, blue for boys. When, I wonder, did this happen? I grew up in an era when toy aisles offered a motley collection of stuff. If a boy wanted a My Buddy doll, he'd have to walk past the My Kid Sister displays or the Barbie collections. Oh, the torture. Nowadays, if a boy wants a doll, it's practically a national emergency, sparking stories about the downfall of men. Curious, I take a look at the blue aisle and begin to note that most of the toys for boys, the action figures, battle bots, and race cars, seem to send a similar message. Do things. I wander over to the pink aisles, and note the lipstick and the Bratz dolls, the dress-up gowns, and that creepy plastic head meant for girls to practice hair designs and makeup application. The message? Appearance is everything. I'm beginning to fume, wondering how a parent is supposed to raise strong, confident, happy young girls in the era of Snookies and Kardashians, when the deck is stacked from childhood with the idea that girls are supposed to look pretty, while boys are supposed to be active. I talk to my daughter about the commercials we see on TV and the ads she spots around town, but is that enough? I'm in the doll area now when I hear the pitter-patter of small feet whispering down the aisle. A girl zips by and picks up a doll that somehow looks old-fashioned and innocent amid all the chain-smoking, waifish supermodel dolls. I think someone must have left it behind. The girl is overjoyed. "Can I, Mom?" she begs, clutching the doll to her chest. "Can I?" The mom catches up and makes a face. "That one? She looks so fat." The girl frowns and places the doll back on the shelf, a finger tracing the golden hair. The girl is probably 4. It feels like we've entered a bizarro era when it comes to our girls. They're outpacing boys in obtaining college degrees and taking leadership roles at the office and in politics. But how can that last when every marketing message tells them the same thing? "Relax. Focus on fashion instead. Here, have a cupcake. And my, don't your bangs look fabulous." What's a parent to do? Then I hear the words again. "She looks so fat." I watch the girl in the toy aisle. She turns briefly before rounding the corner, following in her mom's footsteps.
San Francisco writer Mike Adamick authors the blog Cry It Out, Memoirs of a Stay-at-Home Dad. Whether you're a parent, a child, or someone without kids, we'd love to hear your thoughts about the California Report. Send email to calreport@kqed.org. You can also comment on specific stories online. Just go to californiareport.org. And for more health coverage, check out our blog, State of Health. You'll find a web-only story about parenting autistic children, plus lots of news about health issues across California. Just visit californiareport.org and click on State of Health. While you're there, you'll see everything we archive, and if you feel like listening on your own time, check out our podcast. You can sign up for it at californiareport.org or look for us at iTunes. Our next story explores how parents and their children often look at the same set of facts or circumstances and see things very differently. Teresa Torres and her son Justin live just a couple miles from each other in San Francisco. I met with them separately at their homes to hear their recollections of a family crisis 15 years ago.
I think that there are things that I remember that Justin doesn't, and I think there were things Justin remembers that I don't. And I think they both can be true.
I don't know. I think that we make our narratives to suit ourselves. And, you know, we have to figure out a way to live with all that we've been through, you know. And she's found her way and, you know, I've found mine.
In the 1990s, Teresa Torres and her husband left New York City for a small town north of Syracuse.
We thought they'd be happier if they were upstate New York where there was, you know, room for riding bicycles and puppy dogs and all that stuff. So we moved upstate and that's where Justin was born.
As a half-Puerto Rican teenager who was struggling with his sexuality, Justin's memories of his hometown are more mixed.
I stuck out, you know. I wasn't the kind of... I wasn't one to blend in very well.
Justin's parents, married as teenagers, split up when he was 12, leaving Teresa to raise three teenage boys by herself. As Justin grew older, he turned inward.
His eating behavior became very strange. He was not sleeping well. He's lots of signs of depression, just lots and lots of signs of depression.
Justin admits he expressed his darker thoughts in his artwork, with images some might find shocking. He also wrote in a journal that he kept hidden.
It was factual, and it was made up, and it was like really kind of exploring the shameful, you know, desires that a teenager might have, and just like melodramatic and over the top. And she found that, and I was, you know, I wasn't out. I hadn't really, as much as it was like obvious, it still was a giant secret for me. You know, she freaked out and she called my father, and who I hadn't seen in who knows how long.
I freaked out. I did. But not because he was gay. It had nothing to do with him being gay. I freaked out because I thought he was going to hurt himself. I thought he was so depressed and so overwhelmed and in such distress that he was going to hurt himself.
Justin's parents confronted him, said it was time for a family meeting. Instead, they got in the car and took Justin to a mental hospital.
And then in the waiting room, I overheard my mother talking about how she had read my journal.
Then, with his parents and two older brothers looking on, Justin exploded.
If somebody had come along and kind of recognized, you know what I mean, like, hey, you know, like, you're a little gay boy, you got a little bit upset, you know what I mean, like, you felt misunderstood, like, you're fine, like, it's going to be fine, there's a big wide world out there, there's nothing to worry about here. Well, I didn't get that response at all, you know what I mean? I got medicated, I got a lot of medication.
Justin remained in the psychiatric hospital for several months.
After work, I'd stop every day. He wouldn't talk to me, though. He wouldn't talk to me. I didn't know why he wouldn't talk to me. Apparently, he was very angry at me because he felt like I put him in there, but I didn't put him in. I took him for help to ask them what I should do, and they said, oh, yeah, we need to admit him.
Putting me in the mental hospital was, I think it was a big mistake. You know, I think I would have gotten through it. You know, I think I was in a lot of pain, and, you know, I was like, I would have made bad choices and been self-destructive, but I don't think I would have actually tried to kill myself.
Justin's mom says it was a tough call putting him away, but she trusted the professional's advice.
I was emotional and I was, you know, very sad and very scared, but I was also a good mom, you know, a person who was trying to do what's the best for my kid.
After I got in the mental hospital, I kind of lost all hope, you know what I mean? Like I said, I don't think that I would have done anything serious to myself. But when my parents kind of brought me to the mental hospital, plopped me down, outed me, and just like having that label and that stigma, and people just really believed that I was nuts, you know? And it kind of shook me to my core.
After several months, Justin was released from the hospital.
And when they were ready to release him, I knew he wasn't ready to go. I had it in my gut. I had it. I saw it in his eyes. I just knew when they, and they said, we're going to release him and we're going to send him home with these three jars of pills.
Justin refused to go with his mother. Instead, he went to his father's house and promptly swallowed 90 of those pills.
I wouldn't have killed myself in my mother's home. I wouldn't have done that to her.
And he really did almost die that time. He had to have his stomach pumped. He was in a coma. It was horrible. It was the most horrible experience any parent can ever imagine.
But this story has a happy ending. Today, Justin is a Stegner Fellow in Stanford's Creative Writing Program, and last year he published a book titled We the Animals, a kind of autobiographical novel inspired by his childhood.
And I think it helps me to, like, move past it, to process it, to see the humor and levity in it, and just to, like, again, forgive myself and other people involved.
Teresa Torres is a high school counselor. She works to stop the bullying of high school kids, the kind of kid Justin was 15 years ago. They're still working through their relationship, but she says she considers herself lucky to have a son like Justin. And he says he's proud of his mom, especially the work she does with minority youth and teens struggling with their sexuality. Call it work-life balance, the juggle, or the seesaw, most parents in California are doing it. According to the Sloan Work and Family Research Network, almost two-thirds of the state's households with school-aged kids have both parents working outside the home. But striking the balance is an issue all families grapple with, as reporter Rachel Dornhelm found out.
Kathy Payne's alarm goes off at 4:30 a.m. on weekday mornings. Without waking her husband and 4 and 7-year-old boys, she pops up and starts going down her list, checking email, exercising, starting a load of laundry. By the time her husband Mateo emerges around 7 a.m., she's showered and packed a lunch to take to her full-time job as a program coordinator for the Oakland Unified School District. Mateo, who also works full-time, starts in on the dishes that piled up the day before. He's in charge of food in the family. He says for dinner, sometimes he cooks, or sometimes...
Sometimes he'll eat cereal, because that's what they want. It's like there's food prepared, and they're like, can I have cereal? And it's like, really? You're going to eat Cheerios for dinner? Okay.
Pretty cool.
Kathy comes in, and the two talk logistics, which can change every day.
And then, so you'll make lunch for Elijah, or is he eating school lunch?
They coordinate which of their cars the babysitter will borrow, and Kathy glances at a clock to see what time it is. 7:15.
Rushing in the morning is no fun at all, especially trying to rush kids. It's just, you're guaranteed to have a meltdown, guaranteed to have a disaster, trying to get a 4-year-old to hurry up and put on his clothes.
As if on cue, the boys pad out. 7-year-old Elijah pours himself a bowl of cereal, and the sweet smell of maple fills the kitchen as Kathy helps 4-year-old Cameron make instant oatmeal.
¿Tú quieres poner la leche?
Yeah.
Okay.
By myself.
By yourself?
I can't.
Toothbrushing almost gets lost in the shuffle, but someone remembers, and then Elijah's headed out the door to walk himself the few blocks to school. Mateo follows. He has to be home from work by 5 to relieve the babysitter and take the kids to swim lessons.
Say bye, Daddy.
Bye, Daddy.
I love you. All right, bye, baby.
Bye.
If all this seems to be running very smoothly, Kathy wants you to know it didn't always. Last year, the former teacher put in 12-hour days as a site administrator and then brought work and some stress home. One day, Mateo called her at work, saying Elijah couldn't breathe and they were going to the emergency room.
And that day we had this back-to-school night, and I'm in the middle of talking to a parent about this suspension and these discipline issues, and it was like, I have to go.
She jumped when another job opportunity at the district appeared and started making time for herself to go to a ballet class twice a week where she doesn't think of anything but where her feet have to go next. Trying to schedule that personal time is key to many working parents. For Karen Witham, a writer in the financial industry, it means reading on her bus ride back home from San Francisco to Oakland. One recent evening, Witham arrives home to see her family. 4-year-old Dominic, her husband Bill, and almost 3-year-old Genevieve.
So, hello. Hi, baby gopher. I missed you today.
Bill stays home with the kids during the day. Karen says that doesn't mean they don't have a juggle.
I think there is this perception that if there is one parent that stays at home, that you're kind of, you know, you're affluent, you're kind of on easy street, and one or both of you has it easy.
Karen says despite an understanding workplace, it hurts to leave the kids in the morning. She treasures reading to them at night.
He dreamed of snowmen big as a house. Tabby,
I go to church, really.
Bill says balance is also elusive as a stay-at-home parent.
Like when she was on vacation over the holidays, technically, I guess this is my occupation, so therefore I don't have a vacation. I really have a greater appreciation as to what my mother and her contemporaries went through. I had no idea.
It's not just feeling isolated, we actually are more isolated.
That's Christine Carter, sociologist, author of Raising Happiness, and a single parent to 9 and 11-year-old daughters. She says even though parents may feel completely maxed out, joining groups is important.
Because that really impacts our happiness when we feel connected, and we feel we have a safety net, and when we feel like we're not the only ones who don't have it figured out.
Carter says you can't fix everything overnight. Try and focus on one small area each month and prioritize a regular time when you do something that's a hobby or a passion. It could be ballet or reading or, in stay-at-home dad Bill's case, music.
I wrote this song for my daughter while she was taking a bath.
For the California Report, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
And Rachel has more strategies and skills for juggling that work-life balance. You'll find other tips from the families she interviewed at our blog, State of Health. You can post your own ideas, too. Just visit californiareport.org and click on State of Health. And that is The California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is our technical producer, with additional engineering by Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks. Our interns are Andres Barraza and Liz Reed. Thanks also to Rebecca Wolfson. Our producer is Victoria Maleon. Our senior editor this week is Polly Stryker. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org. And the SunPower Corporation, offering high-efficiency solar energy solutions to households and businesses in California and worldwide. The world standard for solar. SunPowerSolar.com.